the church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your word. Help us to fight this evil.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
We thank the justices for letting us get married in California, but that's not enough. It's got to go nationwide, and we can't wait for that day.
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA. And those same children who happen to be gay will be free to love and get married, as Thea and I did, but with the same federal benefits, protections, and dignity as everyone else.
We look forward to using the words married and husband, because those words do matter. They are important. I said it in my testimony in court. If they weren't important, we wouldn't be standing here today.
Today is a good day. It's the day I finally get to look at the man that I love and finally say, will you please marry me?
We have now taken this country another important step towards guaranteeing the promise that is in our Constitution, in our Declaration of Independence. This is a victory not just for us, not just for the plaintiffs, not even just for the people who have worked for this so many decades, but for all Americans.
The voices of the plaintiffs and of one of the attorneys that were on the court of the U.S. Supreme Court today at the announcement of two decisions having to do with same-sex marriage. It is historic. It is it's something we'll have to contemplate and study for a while. What does the Bible have to say, if anything, about same-sex marriage? Joining us to answer that question, Dr. Robert Gagnon, Associate Professor of New Testament at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, author of the book The Bible and Homosexual Practice, and co-author of Homosexuality and the Bible. Dr. Gagnon, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
How would you respond to someone who says, just give me a Bible passage that says we can't get married, same-sex couples can't get married, about a minute and a half before we take a break?
Well, we go from Genesis to Jesus to Paul. Paul, Jesus himself defined marriage on this basis. Genesis 1:27, male and female, he made them. And Genesis 2:24, for this reason, a man may become joined to a woman and the two become one flesh. Jesus regarded those two texts and the Genesis creation text as defining marriage. Marriage is not merely a human institution, he argues, that humans can tinker with and change at will as they like. But marriage is ultimately defined by God in creation. God is the creator. Out of creation comes nature. Human beings are made and designed in a way that's suitable to the institution of marriage. Anatomically, physiologically, psychologically, in every respect, the true complement or a counterpart to a man is a woman and a woman is a man. And no amount of legislating, no amount of court rulings can change that reality that God has designed and embedded in creation itself. So Jesus is making appeal to the Genesis creation text. He's saying these are normative and prescriptive for all sexual ethics. Paul himself, in his two major statements against homosexual practice in Romans 1:24-27 and in 1 Corinthians 6:9, each text he also has in the background. In the first, Genesis 1:27, male and female he made them, and in the second, the Genesis 2:24 text that Jesus cited. So the entirety of Scripture is absolutely univocal on this matter.
With about a minute here, even if we viewed it only in terms of natural law, not in terms of what you have laid out there in terms of the biblical witness, should one be wary of attempting to take a path other than the one that seems to be laid out by the simple sexual dichotomy of male and female? About a minute.
We should recognize that Scripture's stance combines the direct revelation of Scripture with the indirect revelation that we see in nature. In other words, God declares a design to us that he has in creation. That's in the direct revelation of running from Genesis through Revelation. But that design is at the same time embedded in creation, which is ongoing in the form of nature. And so, therefore, it is a provision that is binding not only on Christians, but also makes sense and is logically and morally binding as well on unbelievers, because man and woman remain what they are, each half of an integrated sexual whole. Man is not the full range of the sexual spectrum, neither is woman. It's in their union of man and woman that one brings a wholeness to human sexuality, where the extremes of a given sex are moderated and the gaps in the sexual self are filled.
Dr. Robert Gagnon is our guest. He'll be with us for a few minutes on the other side of the break. It's Wednesday afternoon, June the 26th. We're talking about the Bible and same-sex marriage. Also in Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., Hadley Arkus will join us to get a legal perspective on the Supreme Court's decisions on same-sex marriage. Also, Albert Mohler will be with us as well. We'll get a social, moral perspective on the decisions made today by the U.S. Supreme Court, or announced today by the U.S. Supreme Court regarding same-sex marriage. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Hour 2 in 5 minutes. More with Dr. Robert Gagnon.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Dr. Robert Gagnon about the Bible and same-sex marriage in light of today's announced Supreme Court decisions regarding same-sex marriage. The Bible and same-sex marriage for the first few minutes of this hour on this Wednesday afternoon, June the 26th. A little bit later, Albert Mohler will be joining us to get a social perspective on the Supreme Court's decision and then a legal perspective on the Supreme Court's decision from Hadley Arkus, professor of jurisprudence and American institutions at Amherst College. He's also written two excellent books, including Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, The Touchstone of Natural Law. That's coming up a little bit later. You can join us, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. Dr. Gagnon, it sounds like what you were saying before the break is that this complementarity between male and female isn't only about sexual orientation, so to speak, but also integrated with marriage. It's also about marriage, too.
Yes, I mean, the way in which men and women are made is exactly and conforms to the way in which God has designed marriage. God has designed marriage as a union of two persons who do not happen to be the same. There's a significant degree of conformity, of sameness between the two. They're both human beings, but there's also a significant degree of otherness, different sexes. We get this issue coming up when in Genesis it talks about finding for the man a partner as his complement or counterpart. And the word there that is used in Hebrew, konegdo, is a word that can refer both to corresponding to in the sense of likeness and also opposite to in the sense of difference. And it's exactly a fellow human being who is of the opposite sex which projects this understanding of a complement or a counterpart.
Are you saying that that complement and that marriage of two different yet complementary things is grounded? Are you going so far as to say it's grounded in created reality?
Yes, it's something that Paul's whole argument, for example, when he discusses the issue of homosexual practice in Romans 1, his point in citing among all sexual offenses homosexual practice is to cite an illustration that shows convincingly that human beings have to suppress the truth about who God is and about the way that God has made them in order to engage in these self-dishonoring, self-degrading practices. So, in effect, this is intended by God to be obvious. To be a little bit anachronistic here, it's not intended to be rocket science or brain surgery. Anyone with a modicum of sense can look at a person of the other sex and say, that person is different in ways that complement who I am as a sexual being. It's true anatomically, physiologically, psychologically, and that is for the health and vitality of the human race. For human beings to reject that is to reject what is obvious, and thereby to hold themselves without excuse before God for rejecting what God has made transparent in nature.
What does not just homosexual behavior, which can be seen as distinct from same-sex marriage, but what does that the two together with same-sex marriage do to that reality?
Same-sex marriage, which first of all is an oxymoron, it's a ludicrous kind of formulation because it posits the union or merger of two things that cannot properly unite or merge and become one flesh, because what is missing from that is the absence of a true sexual complement to oneself. What we bring to the table sexually is the sex that we are. What we don't bring is one sex that we are not, which moderates our own extremes and fills in our gaps. So this is essentially a denial of basic reality. And as a denial of basic reality, once you eliminate a male-female requirement for sexual bonds, there's no nature-based, logic-based, morally-based reason by which one would invalidate a sexual union involving three or more persons concurrently, as long as it's adult and consensual, or a sexual union involving close kins, siblings, parent, child, again, as long as it's adult and consensual.
Is that simply to say once you depart from a view of marriage grounded in created reality, you have no point of reference any longer?
Partly to say that, and partly also to make the point that all these things are related to one another, with the foundation of a male-female requirement preceding the others. In other words, Jesus extrapolated a principle about the number of partners in a sexual union ought to be limited to two persons, whether at any one time or serially. For what grounds? On what basis? On the basis that God made us two primary sexes, male and female. So if we say that a male-female requirement is no longer essential for a marital bond, then on what basis would we limit the number of partners to two, since the only basis really which is credible here is the creation of two primary sexes? By the same token, we reject incest because it's a union between persons who are too much alike in their embodied existences, here on the level of kinship. And that analogy is made on the basis of a male-female requirement, which says that, yes, there's a certain amount of otherness in embodied existence required in a sexual bond, here in terms of sexual differentiation, not between man and man or woman and woman, but between male and female. By striking down a male-female requirement, we are saying that uber-sameness, too much likeness on the level of embodied existence, is not a relevant factor in terms of determining what is a valid sexual bond. On that basis, then, if you have two siblings who are adults and committed to one another, and especially if they take birth control precautions, there is no basis logically or nature-based on which the state can invalidate such unions.
How would you respond to two objections? The first one, to the point you just made, someone saying, well, what you're really doing is just kind of positing a slippery slope argument, that if one thing happens, then it's inevitable that another thing may happen down the line. How would you respond to that one first?
A culture can choose to be inconsistent and logically not follow what should follow, but it will not long happen in this case. It's not me who's creating the slippery slope. Those who are rejecting a male-female requirement to marriage are providing all the grease for that slippery slope, because every argument that they use to validate a homosexual union, which invalidates the realities of creation and nature, can equally be used to validate unions involving adult consensual polyamory or incest. It's the same, exact same sort of arguments.
The other objection that's often raised, and you addressed it in part at the beginning of our conversation, but I'd like to come back to it proper, is, and it's often raised, well, Jesus never explicitly addressed the issue of homosexuality, much less of same-sex marriage. What is your full response there?
Well, Jesus never explicitly addressed the issue of incest with your mother or father. He never explicitly addressed the issue of bestiality. But there's no doubt historically that Jesus would have been opposed to such things. Why didn't he address the issue of homosexual practice, incest, and bestiality? because there is simply no cultural divergence in early Judaism on that question, certainly not in Palestine, not even in the Greco-Roman Mediterranean basin in the diaspora of Judaism. Was there any dissenting viewpoint on that issue? For Jesus to have spent any time addressing why you should not be having sex with persons of the same sex or with your mother or an animal would have been a complete waste of time because no Jew is advocating it, much less doing it. What Jesus did do is start with the one area over which there was a problem, namely the number of partners in a sexual union, the allowance to men of polygamy, and the allowance to men of divorce for any cause. And Jesus was able to take that loophole that existed in the law of Moses and close it. Close it on what basis? On the basis of an appeal to a male-female foundation for sexual ethics. On the two-ness of the sexes, he ended with a viewpoint that the number of persons in a sexual union must be limited to two. So eliminate the foundation. You have no basis for establishing the principle of monogamy.
Oh, that, I guess that raises another objection, that, and that is, look at the Old Testament. Although Jesus does close the door on polygamy, eventually it's open for quite some time, and that is an alternate definition of marriage, and all we're really doing is engaging in another alternate definition of marriage. Your response?
Jesus did acknowledge that there were some accommodations in the law of Moses that did not reflect God's creation will for marriage. And he closed those loopholes that existed chiefly for men, not for women. The basis on which he closed it was a male-female requirement. So Jesus is not just simply asserting that marital law is up for grabs and we can pretty much do what we want with the institution of marriage. He was rather saying that Moses made an accommodation for the institution of marriage that is not justified in creation itself. And he made appeal to a male-female requirement to overturn that accommodation. We can hardly now appeal to Jesus and say that the male-female requirement, which he established as foundational for sexual ethics, no longer matters.
With only 30 seconds here, then, Dr. Gagnon, before we take this break, is there any legitimate use of any passage that you can think of that would support the marriage union of same-sex couples?
Absolutely none. The scripture is unremittingly opposed to homosexual practice of every sort, whether it's conducted in an idolatrous or exploitative context, or whether it's conducted in a committed relationship. Every single text of scripture that has anything to do with human sexual ethics always presupposes a male-female requirement from Genesis to Revelation. There's no possibility of rejecting that without rejecting the witness of Jesus and of Scripture generally. The claims that we have some sort of new knowledge about committed homosexual relationships or homosexual orientation simply turn out to be false when we actually look at the evidence from the Greco-Roman and Jewish milieu out of which Jesus operated.
When you look at what was decided today, I guess I want your particular thoughts on the Supreme Court's decision, although we brought you in to talk about the biblical context of these things. What are your reflections as a biblical scholar on what the Supreme Court decided for the United States today?
Well, just as a citizen of the United States, my reflections are these rulings are ludicrous. They're basically absurd. I mean, they say in one decision that the executive branch of a state in California can abdicate its responsibility to defend a law passed by the citizens of the state, and that's to be rewarded. And then on the other hand, they're arguing that the Congress, U.S. Congress, cannot define marriage for its own marriage policies and laws that it puts forward, but now must be subjected to the will of every individual state law. This is utterly absurd. Essentially what, in the last decision, the U.S. Supreme Court is doing is it's saying, look, we don't think that the uniform provision of the U.S. Congress for one marriage law for everybody is a good thing. We're going to let the states have governance over this. Then they're creating a situation where there's going to be unequal policies state by state for persons who are in so-called gay marriage. That will eventually lead the U.S. Supreme Court to say that this unequal application of marriage laws to the various states must now become uniform. So they reject a uniform policy by the federal government to create an option for gay marriage only for some states, which then they will insist must have a uniform law federally. I mean, the whole thing is hypocritical and ironic.
Where do you see it going? from this point on?
The end result is, of course, although the U.S. Supreme Court didn't do it today, Justice Scalia was absolutely correct that the only thing limiting the Supreme Court's decision, not at the present time, to enforce gay marriage in all 50 states was that they didn't think they could get away with it at the present time. Simply by judicial fiat, this U.S. Supreme Court is holding itself open for a time in the not-too-distant future when it will override 20 centuries of rationale about the nature of marriage and override common sense and logic about nature and creation to reinforce its own political ideological objective.
Having made the biblical case, which is very handily made, then do you think that that is the case for the public square when we continue to discuss this issue publicly as Christians?
Do I think that Scripture has any relevance?
No. Do you think that that is the most effective case to make in the public square, the biblical data on the issue?
I think people still give some credence to Jesus as a moral witness, and I think an appeal to him, which is also at the same time an appeal to nature, as is Paul's argument about same-sex intercourse being contrary to nature in Romans 1:24 to 1:27, does still have traction in this society. We have a large number of Christians, and we have people who still think somewhat reasonably, although those numbers are going down, it seems, in every given year. The appeal that's being made is one that is long-standing, and it's one that's grounded in reality. It carries with it religious and moral conviction by persons, particularly in the case of Jesus, that few could argue are simply crackpots that should not be listened to.
I'm wondering your thoughts on, because it's no secret that there are, in mainline Protestantism, several large denominations that have crossed this line before the Supreme Court did. I'm wondering what your thoughts are. Does this serve to undermine both the rational and the biblical arguments for marriage as a man and a woman? About a minute here or so.
Well, the mainline denominations that have done so in opposition to the clear witness of Jesus and of Scripture generally. So with the decision of the Supreme Court and the step already being taken by some mainline denominations to affirm so-called gay marriage, the challenge that presents itself to the church now is to be able to have its voice heard and to make that case from Scripture and to cast aside the misinformation that currently exists about the witness of Jesus and of Scripture generally. Quite frankly, pastors who have wanted to remain silent about this issue for a long time in order to avoid controversy are now going to have to step up to the plate and do the work that they've been called to do all along. Whenever Paul dealt with converts about the issues of faith and about moral conduct, the first issue following idolatry was always sexual ethics. It's time now for the church to do its work.
Dr. Robert Gagnon is Associate Professor of New Testament at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, author of the book The Bible and Homosexual Practice, and co-author of Homosexuality and the Bible. You'll find a link to both of these books and his blog at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Gagnon, thank you for your time.
You're welcome, Todd.
When we come back, Dr. Albert Moeller, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, will be with us to talk about a cultural perspective on the Supreme Court's decisions on same-sex marriage.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
South Africa,
China,
Germany,
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues, Etc. around the world? India,
Sweden,
Egypt,
France,
Turkey,
Japan,
Australia,
Canada,
United Kingdom,
Hong Kong,
Austria,
Finland,
Malaysia,
Singapore,
Bulgaria,
Korea,
Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines.
Mexico.
Spain.
New Zealand.
Kuwait.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's Wednesday afternoon, June the 26th. We are spending the second hour with the best of our guests, getting their perspectives on the Supreme Court's decision on same-sex marriage. Joining us for a cultural perspective, Dr. Albert Moeller, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, a regular guest on the program and author of several books, including Desire and Deceit, The Real Cost of the New Sexual Tolerance. Dr. Moeller, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Todd, it's always great to be with you. Thank you.
Culturally, have we today, with these decisions that have been announced, passed the point of no return?
Well, I don't think a Christian can ever say past the point of no return, but I understand what you're asking, and I would say that the most natural and honest answer to the question is yes. However, it reveals that we crossed it today. I don't think today was the crossing. I think in retrospect, we'll look back and say that the crossing probably took place some time ago in our fairly recent history, when we had so marginalized and subverted marriage that it couldn't even stand up to a challenge such as this.
Are you talking about things as simple as changes in divorce law, changes in the way that marriage was regarded, not only legally but socially in this country?
Absolutely, because the centrality of marriage in human existence, as you and I both know, is not just a sociological fact, it's a divine intention. And so when two out of three couples cohabitate before they get married or cohabitate without reference to marriage, when we've separated procreation from marriage and then marriage and procreation, we accepted no-fault divorce, serial monogamy as a way of adjusting to an adulterous lifestyle, where premarital sex is just no longer even considered to be a moral issue, which means that the very term premarital doesn't even make much sense these days because the marital part never happens. You know, when Justice Kennedy, in the majority opinion today, hands down the fact that that any animus against same-sex marriage is rooted merely in prejudice, then that's an indication that marriage itself simply some time ago collapsed in America's imagination. And I guess we should have noted it when it happened. We just didn't see that magic moment, tragic moment when it happened.
That does not strike me as a particularly legal sentiment on the part of Justice Kennedy. It strikes me as far more social commentary than any kind of constitutional or legal idea.
Well, you know, in an article I published about an hour after the decision came out, I pointed out that Justice Kennedy, once again, as he did in 2003 in Lawrence v. Texas, says that we shouldn't bring moral concerns or moral standards to bear, and then he claims that the opponents of homosexual activity and now same-sex marriage are immoral in their response. So, in other words, he's trapped in the situation that God put him in, as every single human being is in it. We're moral creatures. At the end of the day, we make moral decisions. We can't bracket morality. But what we see here is a moral commentary. And Justice Scalia, in his scathing dissent, just pointed that out. He said this is a court that can't wait to express itself morally on same-sex marriage. And that's exactly what they've done. He nailed it.
I wonder whether or not it's proper to refer to this as one of the most grand social experiments ever attempted in U.S. history. Am I going too far?
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't just stop with American history. You know, the Netherlands was the first country as recently as 2000 to legalize same-sex marriage. I think what shocks me is that we could kind of tell ourselves as Christians in America that the secularization, the radical secularization of Europe, especially Northern and Western Europe, set it into a position where this was likely to happen, but not here. But I think what we're finding out is that we're actually in a far more secularized country than we knew ourselves to be in.
What does that mean, then, for the future? We now have a legal basis upon which at least the legal scholars, Hadley Arkus, will join us here in a few minutes, and I'm sure he'll say, you know, here they come. The briefs are already being filed against laws that would prohibit this.
They should be, because the court just invited them. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, obviously I see this as just an unmitigated tragedy, but Justice Kennedy basically invited any citizen living in a state that doesn't have legal same-sex marriage to claim to be discriminated against on constitutional grounds. Justice Scalia has it exactly right. He said this court is just waiting for the other shoe to drop.
So do we fold up our tents and go home? What What happens next? What would you advise someone who says, look, I've been kind of fighting the legal battle. We've been fighting the political battle here. The legal one has just been almost effectively taken away from us. There's no appeal beyond the Supreme Court. What do you advise?
Well, we're in uncharted territory in one sense, because the Christian church has never faced a broad-scale situation in which a state or a government was at war with marriage in this respect. But I think we're just going to have to proclaim the gospel, first of all. We're going to have to teach the whole counsel of God, and we're going to have to make certain that if the entire world goes insane and forgets what marriage is, that the Christian church does remember what it is. There's some trench warfare to go on here. You know, we're going to have to fight for religious liberty. That's not an extraneous battle. I say that as a seminary and college president, recognizing that my ability to lead this institution, to fulfill its mission, is going to become much more complicated and is directly threatened by this kind of court decision. And at the end of the day, what matters most, as we know, because the Christian church doesn't ask the Supreme Court what marriage is. At the end of the day, we're going to find out what Christians and what individual congregations and what denominations really believe about marriage, which is going to tell us everything they believe about the Bible, about the gospel, and about God.
With Kennedy's statement in the majority opinion, saying that any animus against same-sex marriage is born of bigotry, in essence. Does that lay the foundation for a scrutiny of the church's message on the issue of homosexuality and same-sex marriage?
Well, of course it does. Now, the justice knows full well that what he is doing is creating and helping to create a moral environment in which those who disagree with him and thus the majority of the court are marginalized. That's one of the major functions of the U.S. Supreme Court in this society. Sometimes quite righteously, we have to say, and other times quite unrighteously, and in this case, very unrighteously. But it's going to become a real challenge for us, because what is now successfully happening in the culture is that any kind of moral judgment against homosexuality is being treated as tantamount to racism. So just ask yourself, what happens to a church that preaches a racist message? They're not arrested, their building's not confiscated, but they're on the wrong side, and they deserve to be on the wrong side of every right-thinking person in this country. The attempt at marginalizing those who believe in the sinfulness of homosexuality and in the integrity of marriage is going to go likewise. And then when you get to where you have Christian institutions, there it's going to become far more difficult. The Bob Jones decision, going back now decades, grants the federal government, the IRS, the ability to strip tax exemption from a nonprofit organization that isn't seen to be serving the community interest. And so you can see how that will be used, as it already is right now being used in states like California and New Jersey. The Boy Scouts in California threatened with losing their tax-exempt status simply because they discriminate now just in leadership when it comes to homosexuality. We're going to face, in the coming generation, an endless barrage of these things.
Well, two quick final questions. Should Christians, nonprofits, should they get ready to start paying taxes?
Well, one of the problems of paying taxes is not just a simple thing. Christians, you hear that and they just see a dollar cost. They don't understand what's at stake. For instance, what comes with that is going to financially ruin a lot of institutions. I mean, say you have a downtown church on a busy piece of real estate, they could find themselves in property taxes, unable to even stay in ministry. But beyond that, there are all kinds of privileges that are attached to that become very suspect just in terms of the larger society. So it's going to be a huge challenge.
Finally, with only about a minute here, Dr. Moeller, is this an opportunity for Christians to show the world essentially what God has to say about natural marriage in how we conduct our own marriages? About a minute to respond.
Absolutely. What happens in our marriages is that for which we will answer eternally. And so, absolutely, we have to recognize that the family is, according to God's design, the first church, the first school, and the first government. We have to get it right at home before we can expect anyone to get it right in the culture at large.
What do you say to Christians right now who've been watching this, who watched what happened this morning in Washington, D.C., and who are completely and utterly discouraged?
Well, I fully understand that, and there are grounds for that discouragement, except for the fact that our Christian understanding, our worldview, our eschatology, our understanding of the gospel actually bears no relationship whatsoever to the status, positive or negative, of the United States of America. I'm grateful to be an American citizen. I still am today, even though I see this as a tragic day in our nation's history. But at the end of the day, I'm a Christian, and I have to believe as a Christian that I would have to be faithful regardless of the time, the place, the culture, the regime, the set of laws that I might face. And we've taken so much for granted here. The Supreme Court saw to it today that we could take a lot less for granted as American Christians.
Dr. Albert Moeller is president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. He's author of several books, including Desire and Deceit, The Real Cost of the New Sexual Tolerance. Folks, you can read Dr. Albert Moeller's blog, and I encourage you to do so under the Listen On-Demand page at our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. Moeller, keep up the good work, and thank you very much for being our guest.
God bless you. Always great to be with you.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Hadley Arkus. He's a professor of jurisprudence and American institutions at Amherst College. We're going to be getting a legal perspective on the Supreme Court's decisions on same-sex marriage. So far in this hour, we've gotten the biblical perspective, the cultural perspective, and when we come back, what did they decide today? Some have said that if they made decisions like they did today, it would be the Roe v. Wade of same-sex marriage. I guess that's my first question for Hadley. Is this the Roe v. Wade of same-sex marriage? We will be right back. You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
Issues Etc. What does this mean? We want to hear from you. Why do you listen? How has it helped you? What are your favorite topics? Who are your favorite guests? And what makes Issues Etc. unique? Please leave your thoughts about this worldwide outreach on the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Be sure to give us your first name and tell us where you're from. Issues Etc. What does this mean? 618-223-8382.
Talk radio for the Christian worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Unheard of heroines.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Would you like to get to know the most courageous pro-life women in America? If so, you need to pick up the latest copy of Feminists for Life's magazine. In it, you'll find firsthand accounts by a dozen women who chose life under some of the most difficult circumstances imaginable. For some, their pregnancies were the result of rape. For others, incest. Some were told their unborn child was seriously deformed and would only live for a few moments. But in each case, the mother chose life and says she would gladly do so again.
Are you pro-life? Then visit our website at sba-list.org and discover how you can make a difference. I'm Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. Thanks for taking a stand.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're spending the entire second hour of the program on this Wednesday afternoon, June the 26th, reacting to the Supreme Court's decision on same-sex marriage that were announced this morning. We've had the biblical perspective from Dr. Robert Gagnon. We have had the social or cultural perspective from Albert Mohler just a few minutes ago. Now a legal perspective on the Supreme Court's decisions on same-sex marriage. Hadley Arkus joins us. He's a regular guest. He's professor of jurisprudence and American institutions at Amherst College. He's author of several books, including Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, the Touchstone of the Natural Law. Hadley, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Oh, it's good to be back. Well, I wish not exactly a good day to be back. It's not a good day. I was at the court. I've been at the court every morning this week as people have been expecting the decision to come out and not being sure exactly when it comes out. Well, I heard the decisions spoken today and with the dissenting opinions. But what comes to mind is that line of Mark Twain's about Wagner's music, where he said, "It's not as bad as it sounds." And in this case, it is as bad as it sounds. In fact, it's worse than it sounds, because these decisions affect to be quite limited, yet they can't be cabined. They really put the predicate in place for challenging and sweeping away the laws in the different states and even the constitutional amendments that would offer any resistance or refusal to accept same-sex marriage.
So guests that we have spoken with previously, before the decisions were announced, anticipated that in the worst-case scenario, these decisions, these twin decisions on the Defense of Marriage Act and Prop 8 in California by the Supreme Court, could be what they were calling the Roe v. Wade of same-sex marriage. Were these decisions that?
Well, in effect, they will reach quite as deeply. But on the face of it, they affect to be more limited. I mean, Roe versus Wade virtually swept away all of the laws that refused to accept abortion or put up any barriers to abortion. This one doesn't affect to do that. It does it. Justice Kennedy in the decision on the DOMA case, Defense of Marriage case, insisted that he was reaching only the refusal of the federal government to credit in federal law anything but the marriage of a man and a woman. But he didn't. He insisted that it would not force any particular state to accept same-sex marriage or to credit a same-sex marriage coming in from another state. But he put all the predicates in place that he established, going back in one of his earlier cases, to that the aversion to the homosexual life can be countered only as an irrational animus. And as you said today, the refusal, the notion of defending marriage, the Defense of Marriage Act itself implied, he thought, an inclination to denigrate and demean people who are homosexuals and to deny any dignified standing to their relationships. Well, you put those predicates in place. Litigants will come into the courts saying that the laws we have now in the state that refuse to accept same-sex marriage are laws that implicitly demean, denigrate, degrade gays and lesbians and their relationships. Those laws then can find no reasoned ground of justification. They can be attributed simply to, once again, an irrational animus. And the decision was, in the other case, the Hollingsworth versus Perry from California, the governor of the state had refused to defend their constitutional amendment to preserve marriage as a relation between one man and one woman. And the court held today that when the governor refused to defend the case, that the backers of the measure, the people who pushed this as a constitutional, who worked hard to get it enacted, the backers had merely, quote, an ideological interest. They had no personal stake in it, nothing comparable to the stake held by the gay or lesbian couple whose marriage would be denied under the laws. And so the holding was that the backers of the legislation, the backers of the Constitution Amendment, the voters who supported it, the legislators who might support it, had no standing in the court to defend the constitutional amendment that sought to defend marriage as we know it. Well, put this together. Even if a state passes a constitutional amendment to secure marriage as a relation of one man and one woman, a litigant can come into court, claim that that marriage really is, that constitutional amendment has no real just, rational justification. If there is a Democratic governor or a liberal governor of the state, the governor can refuse to defend that constitutional amendment in the court. The courts can now say that the people who enacted the constitutional amendment, the legislators say who enacted it, have no real standing to sue in a court because they have no personal interest at stake. So that constitutional amendment can be sort of waved aside as a nullity. So again, Justice Kennedy affected to pretend that his decision was very limited. Chief Justice Roberts affected to have a decision equally limited, but as though they're simply holding back from deciding. But as Justice Scalia quipped, these are bold and unreasoned disclaimers. They will not stand. The language used by Justice Kennedy in the DOMA case, combined with the decision by Chief Justice Roberts, that you put those two in place, they give you the equipment, the weapons, I should use some other word, they give you everything you need to bring down all the other challenge and overturn any of the laws or constitutional amendments of the country that would refuse to credit same-sex marriage.
So can you explain in the simplest terms how the court ruled on DOMA?
Well, there are two parts of DOMA. One said that the federal government has to explain what is regarded as a marriage in federal court, in the federal laws, in the federal code, because there's a matter of spouses getting special provisions for estate taxes, inheritance, who is married to someone, a citizen of the United States coming in from abroad. And surely you would think that Congress has the unquestioned authority to determine the meaning of terms in the federal code. That's all that Justice Kennedy pretended to affected to strike down today. He was saying that by withholding the recognition of same-sex couples in federal law, they're refusing to honor the same-sex marriages that were accepted in the laws of New York and other places. That's all. The part of DOMA is that it had the federal government, the Congress, establishing a certain understanding of what was regarded as marriage and the understanding of marriage that we're trying to preserve. And in the second part of DOMA, the part that Justice Kennedy pretended he was not going to be touching, the second part simply involved supporting the authority of the state to refuse to credit a same-sex marriage coming in from another state, because we have the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution, Article 4, that in the same way that we expect the state to honor a driver's license obtained in another state, we usually expect the states to honor a marriage that was established in another state, except when the state may have a moral objection to certain forms of marriage, such as incestuous marriage or marriage of people below a certain age. And what the Congress sought to do was shore up the authority of the state to refuse to recognize a same-sex marriage coming in from another state. Now, that's the part that Justice Kennedy pretended he was not reaching. He suggested that that his decision today would leave intact the authority of a state to make its own decisions about marriage and to refuse to credit marriages coming in from another state. But I think, as Justice Scalia said, that disclaimer will soon be undone.
Hadley Arkus is our guest. We're getting a legal perspective on the Supreme Court's decision on same-sex marriage on this Wednesday afternoon, June the 26th. He's professor of jurisprudence and American institutions at Amherst College. He's author of several books, including Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, the Touchstone of the Natural Law. When we come back, I'd like his reaction to part of what Antonin Scalia, one of the justices of the Supreme Court, dissenting in one of the decisions announced today, had to say. Says it takes real cheek for today's majority to assure us that it's a constitutional requirement to give formal recognition to same-sex marriage is not at issue here. We'll hear the whole quote and see what Hadley has to say about it right after this.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Would you like to help your son or daughter achieve their maximum athletic potential? Hi, this is Jeff Schwarz, General Manager of Lutheran Public Radio. My friend, fellow parishioner, and certified athletic trainer, Kevin Reisick, is the owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. Arch Fitness specializes in sports performance training for middle school to collegiate level athletes. For more information, call Kevin at 618-670-6952. 618-670-6952.
Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+. Simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Hadley Arkus is our guest. We're getting a legal perspective on the Supreme Court's decisions on same-sex marriage announced today. Hadley Arkus is professor of jurisprudence and American institutions at Amherst College. Hadley, I'm going to read a little bit of what Antonin Scalia said in one of his dissents announced today, and I want to know if you can explain it to us. He says, "It takes real cheek for today's majority to assure us as it's going out the door that a constitutional requirement to give formal recognition to same-sex marriage is not at issue here. I promise you this," he says, "the only thing that will confine the court's holding is its sense of what it can get away with." What is Justice Scalia saying there?
He was really recalling his an exchange of 10 years ago in a case called Learns versus Texas, where Kennedy once again wrote for the court and saying that you can't cast an adverse judgment on homosexual relation. He was striking down law on sodomy in Texas. He's saying, no, you may not cast an adverse moral judgment on these sexual relationships, but he's insisting at the same time that nothing he was saying there would entail any judgment upon any other formal recognition of homosexual relations, that is to say, marriage. Scalia was arguing that once you put those predicates in place, you set the ground for calling into question laws on marriage that would refuse to accept same-sex marriage. And Kennedy was saying, no, that's not necessarily implied in what I'm saying here. But now exactly, now he's pointing out, no, Kennedy is dropping the other shoe. He is, what Kennedy is doing now is showing that that was indeed the natural implication of what he was saying when he was saying that you cannot cast any adverse moral, can't find fault with it, cast any morally adverse judgment on a homosexual relation. And if that's the case, why does that not entail a judgment on same-sex marriage? How does one find fault with it? How does one refuse to accord to it the dignity that would and respectability that would attach to other marriages? So in the same way, he's saying Justice Kennedy is pretending to leave unaffected the authority of a state to sustain marriages, marriage of a man and woman, and to refuse to credit same-sex marriages coming in from another state, but that Kennedy, as in the case of same-sex marriage here, Kennedy has now simply removed any plausible ground on which a state would defend its laws if it sought to retain them.
So if someone were to decide, and inevitably someone will decide, to challenge in court a state law or a state constitutional amendment defining marriage as a man and a woman.
They will. It's virtually predictable in every place. They'll take advantage of this opinion. Yeah.
And it will make its way back up to the Supreme Court, perhaps comprised the same way it is today, or perhaps with a few different justices sitting on it, depending how long it takes.
It will not even make its way up to the Supreme Court.
What will happen?
It'll just be settled. You have a district court judge. You have a district court judge declaring that the laws in the state are unconstitutional. And the court will see nothing here that raises any novel issue. That it's simply all covered by the decisions that were taken today. No novel question would be raised. It probably would simply be. Would probably be accepted, unless people really want to take seriously Kennedy's notion that it has to be argued all the way up to the court, because Kennedy really meant what he said when he said that nothing here implied a judgment on the authority of the state to refuse to recognize same-sex marriages. But we know how that's going to come out. It's virtually inescapable that litigants will come forward now to challenge every one of these laws that remain on the books, and the district courts will confirm them. If they don't, it'll be taken to appellate courts, which will simply invoke these cases and confirm them. And it would take something truly novel in the case to bring it before the Supreme Court again.
With regard to the referendum that brought about Prop 8, what message has the court sent today to citizens of any state that would want to, through referendum, make a law, propose a law, or a constitutional amendment regarding defining marriage as one man and one woman?
Well, the first thing is from Justice Kennedy, as Scalia pointed out, the message to them is, you are animated by malice, bigotry, and hatred. You have no reasoned grounds, nothing other than your hatred for bringing forth measures of that kind, and that's how they'll be received in the courts. And if you, the question comes up, what happens now to that decision in which the court says the backers of this legislation, of this amendment, had no standing to sue. So what happens to all these cases? Well, a district court judge in California struck down the constitutional amendment as running counter to the Equal Protection Clause of the Federal Constitution. Okay, an appellate court later confirmed that decision. The Chief Justice says today that the backers had no standing to launch this suit and maintain this suit in the federal court. Therefore, the federal courts had no real jurisdiction in the case. So that's, he says, will sweep away the opinion of the appellate court. The appellate court then had no jurisdiction to hear the case. Well, then what's the result? Well, either you sweep away that decision to the district court, or you simply say, well, that decision in the district court, it holds only for the gay and lesbian couples who came into that lawsuit, only for the litigants in that case. The decision in the district court, as Scalia pointed out, would have no precedential value binding on any other court in the country, in any other federal court, all right? But we have Justice Kennedy's language. The legislators in California could say, what Kennedy's language establishes is that there was something constitutionally dubious, infirm, and wrong about Proposition 8 itself. So we, the legislators, will now regard Proposition 8 as constitutionally dead. And we will feel free now to start legislating on the assumption that it is legitimate for us to establish and promote same-sex marriage. So I think, given what's put forth today, it's all in the works. The only remedy, I think, now at this stand, for people who try to defend marriage as we know it, is a constitutional amendment originated within the states themselves. If two-thirds of the states, legislatures of the states, call for a constitutional convention, that's another way of calling forth a convention that would have as its focus amending the Constitution on this matter of marriage to take it away from the courts. Now, that's a long shot, but look, we have all these states now that have incorporated in their Constitution a defense of marriage, and all these states that have a defense of traditional marriage on their books, they have something at stake now, because as a result of these decisions today, their laws, their constitutions, are now in danger of being overturned. So this may be the only path most open right now to people who would try to do something to counter these incredible decisions of the court today on the matter of marriage.
So with only a minute, Hadley, has the U.S. Supreme Court today in effect said that any legal or constitutional defense or limitation to the definition of marriage is unconstitutional?
They won't exactly say that, but it is suspect, dubious, animated by hatred, and I would then say not likely to survive a review in this court.
Hadley Arkus,
grim news for us today.
Hadley Arkus is professor of jurisprudence in American institutions at Amherst College. He's author of several books, including Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, the Touchstone of Natural Law. You'll find a link to this book and to Hadley's National Review online columns under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Thank you, Hadley.
Okay, thank you.
Folks, if you appreciate this biblical, cultural, legal response to timely stories like today's Supreme Court decisions on same-sex marriage, help support Issues Etc. Talk Radio for the Christian Worldview by making a tax-deductible gift. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. Send it to Issues Etc., Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Here's the address again. Issues Etc., Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind during the difficult summer months. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Terry Mattingly of Scripps Howard News Service about the media coverage of today's Supreme Court decisions. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. In a way, nothing's changed. We knew that something like this was going to happen. Maybe not a Supreme Court decision, but we knew that the culture is never on our side. Even the law is not on our side. The truth that God has built into creation, revealed in His Word, and confirmed through His Son, Jesus Christ, the truth is on our side. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.